Coming up next on Tech News Today, the partnership for AI is going to make sure that the singularity never happens. Google is making its apps for work even smarter, as well as rebranding them as G Suite. Yo. Trading microabrasions for cracked glass, the story behind the creation of Tetris, and Samsung's next exploding thing apparently is a washing machine. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1609, recorded Thursday, September 29th, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Gazelle, the online marketplace for buying and selling used gadgets. Shop from a variety of certified pre-owned electronics or trade one in for cash. Give a new life to a used device. Visit gazelle.com today.
And by LinkedIn Learning, develop talent and keep skills current with expert-led, on-demand e-learning. To request a demo for your organization or get a free individual trial, visit learning.linkedin.com/twit.
Welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about everything that happened in technology today. And we are the Kyle and Stan of Tech News.
Kyle. No, I can't do that.
Well, good. Okay, I knew I would get a reference. Eventually.
I would rate that like a C-, actually. That was a really bad impression.
I liked it.
Okay, it was good. I mean, it was loud, so I got the loud part right. But everything else was wrong.
And you know, if you haven't watched the show before, I just throw these out there.
I don't know what's coming. You have no idea, no way to prepare.
This is our little ad lib.
You throw out a Cumberbatch, and I'm thrown off completely. But you throw out a Kyle, I know what you're talking about.
Exactly. Shall we get to the tech news?
Yes.
All right. Amazon, Google, Facebook, IBM, and Microsoft are joining forces to create a nonprofit aimed at making sure robots don't kill all humans. Mm. Not right away, anyway. The Partnership on Artificial Intelligence to Benefit People and Society, or the Partnership on AI for short, will conduct research, create standards, and promote best practices for our future that is increasingly being controlled by black box algorithms owned by these large companies. Right now, the Partnership for AI only includes these big five, but they say they will allow others to join in the future, like perhaps Apple or Tesla, for example.
Strange that Apple isn't in on this at the get-go,
I know. That's the one that I was most surprised about. But Tesla, too. I mean, those are the algorithms that we're literally going to be putting our lives at the hands of. You know, the self-driving car algorithms. It's more than just like, oh, you know, what does Facebook know about us and how are they using it? These are our lives. So Elon Musk, of course, has OpenAI. That's his organization that does the same thing. But definitely this is needed. We need a standard of ethics
for
all this artificial intelligence.
Yeah, just giving some sort of thought to the potential, you know, the potential kind of roadmap progression of things like technology that, you know, and we've talked about it plenty of times on the show before, the importance of thinking now what the long-term ramifications of our thinking now is for the future. And I mean, it's necessary. We're talking about, I've just slowly over the course of this year realized just how rapidly it seems artificial intelligence and deep learning, which is kind of a pretty current, you know, recent thing, how rapidly that's gone from, isn't it interesting that they're focusing time on these things, to we're integrating all of our products with this now. Like, it is really one of the marquee keystone features, or, you know, I don't know, underpinnings of a lot of the technology that we use regularly. And it seems to have become that so quickly. So something like this is desperately needed, I think.
Absolutely. And it's important that these big companies are working together, because part of the problem is, I mean, the dream of all this AI is that it will be fairer. It's math, you know, it's just, this is how, you know, this just makes sense. Math has one answer, that sort of thing. But they're all trade secrets. I mean, all of these algorithms are these big companies' trade secrets. They're keeping them from us. We don't know how they work. And we're handing over more and more of our personal information, like I said before, with self-driving cars, our lives. So yeah, I mean, it's great that they're all working together, and I'm excited to see what they will do.
Yeah, and it's not just ethics either, because ethics is a big part of it, but it's also you know, public concerns, both rational and irrational. You know, there's the, are robots going to take our jobs? That might be a rational kind of consideration. Should I fear the singularity? That might be an irrational. It might actually be a rational consideration that you just don't know. And that's why these things are kind of important now, as opposed to once it's too late and the singularity is nigh.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell that Google is getting a number of pre-announcements out before next week's big event. Today's roundup includes a rebranding of Google Apps for Work to G Suite. The letter G and then suite. I don't know if I care for that too much. Google says it reflects its ambitions in helping innovation and collaboration to thrive in the workplace. Google wants to make sure that it's seen as a suite of interconnected tools and not just a bunch of disparate tools, basically. Google's also doubling up on AI integration, like we were just talking about, within the suite by bringing those smarts to Google Drive for quick access, which is a way to get users to the file that they're looking for in half the time as before. And that's all based on prediction algorithms of what you'll need at any given moment. Google's doing a lot of predictive stuff lately, and now they're bringing that into Drive. Google combines all of its cloud services under the Google Cloud brand as well. It's another kind of thing that they're doing. And yeah, I mean, they're making a number of changes here. I mean, I can rattle off a few of these. Calendar smart scheduling, which actually has already been on Android, is coming to iOS very soon. That's basically suggests meeting times, rooms based on kind of the insights that's gathered behind the scenes through artificial intelligence. Sheets. This one's actually really cool. A third of users don't understand how formulas work inside the spreadsheets app, Sheets. And so they're going to use natural language questions that users can use, like, what if, you know, basically just spell out the thing you're looking for in natural language, and it will translate that into a formula and figure out the formula for the answer. And, you know, you can clear that and import that into your sheet. Some smart things in Slides for offering up layout suggestions based on things like color palette and resolution of the images that you've imported. Just a number of things to use AI to make their docs and, you know, collaboration tools smarter.
Well, we use Google for work. G Suite. We're in the G Suite. Yo.
feels like it needs a yo at the end of it.
I don't use a lot of the, I mean, we use Sheets every day for everything that we do. I clicked on the little button that it said to click on. So it says, like, you know, we will create a graph or something, and our whole sheet is full of words, not really numbers. So I tried to click on it, and it says you click explore, and it says there is nothing interesting here now.
Thanks. We've only based an entire show around that nothing interesting.
But
a lot.
It does say it works better with numbers.
Yeah.
So you know, it did create a graph over, like, we have one little row that where we ask for people's pictures that are coming on, guests that are coming on, and it said the percentage of people that had given us pictures versus not. So okay. I could see it being helpful. They also have all these artists that drew little doodles, and I have one there in the doc, which I just think they probably drew this after us because it looks exactly like what we do with Google Sheets every day. There we are.
Oh, that's us.
Because when you're working at home or I'm working at home, and we fist bump each other through it, and we do a lot of that.
That's us going, G Suite, yo.
That is us. They should have called it that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to this.
I will certainly use a good amount of this stuff as a pretty hardcore Google user these days. One thing that they also announced that we'd heard that they had mentioned would happen, like Allo is kind of like the consumer facing messaging app that they're really, you know, that Google's really, really behind now. So what would happen with Hangouts? They said when they announced it, at least eventually, that Hangouts would become more enterprise, more business focused. And essentially part of the earlier adopter program, there's a revamped Hangouts for up to 50 video participants, screen sharing, calendar integration, no download or plugin needed. So kind of meant to be like you're at work kind of communication method for all of your teams. I mean, up to 50 participants. That's kind of crazy. So cool stuff.
Well, those of us who've ever dreamed of making a living from the written word might be saddened by this next story, so consider that your trigger warning. This week, Zach Whitaker from ZDNet uncovered a scammer on Amazon who managed to sell over $3 million worth of typo-filled garbage on the Kindle store. He used a collection of 83,899 fake email addresses, anonymized bots run through the Tor website server, and a stock photo of a businessman man in shirt with pleased expression on his website was not him. This Love scammer that. was not this businessman with pleased expression. And so the website that he had this website. It's a hilarious website. It says, done for you book. That's a quote, like a book done for you. And then they promised dozens of honest, positive reviews if you would, sign up for this service.
You could take out that word honest and you might be accurate.
Right. You can't promise someone, I'm going to promise whatever you write, you're going to get dozens of honest, positive reviews.
If they had put honest in air quotes, then that may have worked.
So through Whitaker's research, he forced the scammer offline. He said he emailed him. And then his Twitter went offline, his email address went offline. And so you got to read Whitaker's piece on ZDNet. It's a must read if you're interested in how easy it is to make money as an author on Amazon if you don't mind scamming all of your readers and writing garbage.
I mean, I feel like time and time again, maybe not on Amazon. I feel like this isn't just limited to Amazon. Like there is an industry created, and it kind of blows me away, but it makes perfect sense when you think about it from an enterprising individual person looking to make money off of things that exist already. It actually makes a lot of sense of this junk writing, essentially, of create. Like I feel like I do a search on Google or online or whatever, and I'm like researching a topic, and it takes me to a site that maybe I've never heard of the site, but the title of the article sounds totally applicable to what I'm looking for. And so I go there, and yeah, it's written by somebody, and it's about the thing that it says it's about, but it's not the same somehow,
right.
Be it spelling, grammar, or just be it really kind of light on actual information, mm-hmm. even though it's like 3 or 4 paragraphs long. Like I know everybody watching and listening has probably encountered this once or twice, and you're like, what did I just look at? Like, what was that? Is this an actual article? And I mean, it's weird to like delineate between the two. On one hand, you've got people whose career it is to write professional, thought-provoking, let's say, well-researched, spell-checked, all this kind of stuff that we expect to find. And then you've got these people that have a career writing whatever they're writing about, but super fast. Mm-hmm. They're just running through it, all for the purpose of serving up this page to host the site on, so everyone that gets tricked in some way, shape, or form of landing there ends up making them a little bit of money based on this kind of like pretend copy.
Yeah, click farms.
Completely.
Yeah, and it's
kind of the same thing. Anyways.
Right. I mean, because there are people that will do it. I mean, they'll get paid like, 50 cents for a 100-word article or something. And, it's based on what people are searching for on Google. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of how-to stuff. And you have no idea if it's how to do that thing or not. So, yeah. So what he did was the scammer got caught by not putting a password on his server, which I thought was pretty funny. Yeah. Put these books on the Kindle store for free, and then he would have all these people buy them, all of his fake email addresses buy them, and so then it would raise up in popularity, and then he would make it charge again. But so that's what happens when a book is free for a while or discounted. It will rise up in popularity, and people will say, oh, well, that's the 5th most popular book on, cooking with rhubarb. I'm going to absolutely buy that. And then, it's just they don't even know how to spell rhubarb. I also don't know how to spell rhubarb.
It's R-E-W-D-R-A-R-B. Rhudarb, I think is what it is, actually.
Yeah. But we are not trying to write books on rhubarb.
No, we just have to say the word. That's way easier than writing it out. The FCC voted to make wireless emergency alerts on cell phones a bit more information rich. The update to the rules would allow for up to 360 characters. Currently, the limit is 90. These are those messages that you get for like an Amber Alert or something along those lines on your phone when there's an emergency. It would also require carriers to support features like embedded telephone numbers that you could, I'm assuming that means that you could tap on it and call right away, as well as links within the alerts. This would allow for things like linking to a photo of a missing child as opposed to a brief all-text alert that you get right now with little more than like a license plate number or seen with a guy. There's only 90 characters, so they really have to trim it down. Beyond that, the new rules would support more targeted geographic ranges for alerts, and a new public safety message alert would be added to inform people of what action they should take when their lives or their property might actually be in danger. Things like emergency shelter locations, places to boil water, let's say, really good changes. I mean, we were talking about this not too long ago. I think it was the beginning of the month about how these alerts could really stand to be upgraded to provide more context than what they do right now. I mean, we've got the ability, we've got the technology. Now it seems that they're putting rules into place or working to put rules in place so that we have the standard.
Yeah, so the bombing suspect in New Jersey, one of these went out, based on a fingerprint that was found on the pressure cooker of the bomb, the explosive device, and then he was caught in 3 hours. So
that's
you think,
crazy.
Yeah, like what could be bad with this? But of course, it's my job to find out the things that could be bad with sending out these alerts. One commissioner said adding multimedia and links, adding context could jam the networks during emergencies, which could be a negative, and they could also drain the battery life on people's phones, and so that you would need your phone. But if there's a bunch of alerts that have, like, you know, a tons of video of this person, that sort of thing, of course the alerts could be wrong as well, and then you have a bunch of people searching for the picture of someone who didn't do anything.
Yeah, it just seems to me like with technology that's supposed to kind of make things easier. And especially when you're talking about a situation where it's an emergency of sorts, like I understand the cause for concern as far as like jamming the networks during an emergency. But if you got the system in place, you might as well give all the pertinent information, and you know, as opposed to not very much and making and then putting so much of the onus on the person receiving it to then take action, whatever that action may be. Seems like a lot more hurdles to jump through when what they are looking for is a solution to the problem, or you know what I mean, or to help the most amount of people. So
exactly. Well, it has been weeks, or at least a week or two, since the launch of the iPhone 7. So clearly it's time to start talking about the iPhone 8. Security analyst Ming-Chi Kuo says the 10th anniversary iPhone will have a glass front and a glass back, like the iPhone 4 and 4S from 2010, with the high-end model sporting stainless steel. 9to5 Mac, who gained access to Kuo's report, says the phones will use 2.5D glass over so-called 3D glass, which is less durable and not so great at not cracking when you drop it. So I'm sure they know that we drop our phones a lot, and so this glass will hopefully be a little stronger. I know they know we always drop our phones in the toilet. That's why they're water resistant. So
yeah, they're listening. Although this kind of feels like going backwards. I feel like, and mind you, this is coming from someone who is apparently really bad at having front and back glass devices, because I've now broken the screen on a couple of them, including one I think it was last weekend with the the Honor 8 or whatever. Anyways, I'm not very good at protecting glass devices. So I feel like front and back glass, like you're trading micro abrasions for delicate glass, essentially. And I don't know if that's a really good trade-off. I understand what they're saying, though, is that the glossy black that they have right now it's really popular. And they want to be able to expand that to more colors. And that's one way to do it, is to bring glass back into the equation and everything. It's just going to make your phone more fragile. And keep that in mind.
Yes, definitely keep that. Did you have a case on your Honor?
No. I mean, no, because, you know, we review a lot of phones here. Like, what I'm realizing now is maybe what I need to do with every phone that I review is also get a case.
Yeah.
And then review the case and the phone. But, you know, that's just an extra step.
It's hard for you. I mean, you go into, like, Target or something, and they have an entire wall of iPhone cases. Four, five, six, seven. You never see the Honor case.
The Honor 8 case. That one case over in the corner. You're lucky if you find that, I think.
Yeah. So yeah. I feel for you.
But I don't know. I just don't know if swapping scratch prone to glass breaking prone is a smart move. But I think it makes for a stylish phone. I love the look of devices that have front and back glass. I just don't think they're super practical.
What about for wireless charging?
Is that better for wireless charging?
I guess so. I mean, I know you can't do wireless charging through this, but I think it's the aluminum.
And that would actually be a really big feature. Like, that's a lot of people are hoping and wondering if and when that's going to happen, because anybody that has the wireless charging on their device, it's one of those features that you don't think you need until you have it, and then you realize how convenient it is and you don't want to go back. So I would not be surprised, especially if the next iPhone is a really big change because of the anniversary coming up, if that would be one of the key features.
Right, and then they could say, like, that's why we took away the headphone jack. We knew all along.
See?
Now you can listen and charge at the same time, and your life is wonderful.
See, we're always right.
Exactly.
Apple.
We're always right. Next up, Dan Ackerman, author of The Tetris Effect, will tell me why I still dream in blocks. I do. But first, let's take a minute to thank Gazelle, the sponsor of this episode. Gazelle is the trusted online marketplace for buying and selling used electronics. If you were thinking of buying a brand new glossy iPhone 7, but you like the idea of a glassy iPhone 8, why not find a less expensive device on Gazelle now? Then you can wait a year, sell it back to Gazelle for enough money to buy the new phone. Or maybe this kind of new all the time attitude isn't for you at all. And if it isn't, I commend you. For trade-ins, simply visit gazelle.com, find your device, and get an instant quote. Shipping is free. Payment is fast. If you're looking to buy a certified pre-owned device, Gazelle has a variety of iPhones, including the iPhone 6S, the 6S Plus. They have iPads. They have Samsung Galaxy phones. They have a lot to choose from. Go to their site, see what they have, browse around to find out if they have the device that you need. Each device is fully inspected and backed by a 30-day return policy and sold without a carrier contract. Go to gazelle.com, see what your old device is worth. Check out the selections of certified pre-owned devices today. Gazelle also offers a 12-month warranty for cell phones and iPads powered by Assurant Solutions that covers water damage, cracked screens, hardware defects, and more. Help is available 24/7 to process claims and return your device ASAP. Devices are available in good and excellent conditions, and all devices have been put through a rigorous 30-point inspection process, ensuring that they are in perfect working order. Give new life to used electronics, trade in for cash, or buy certified pre-owned. Visit gazelle.com today.
All right, we've all played Tetris in our lifetime. Some of us have obsessed over the game, myself included. But behind the scenes, the foundation for what brought Tetris to our screens is actually a pretty remarkable story. Joining us to talk about that story is Dan Ackerman, segment editor at CNET and author of the new book, The Tetris Effect. How you doing, Dan?
Hello, guys, and especially hello to Jason, my former colleague.
That's
here
right.
At
It's good to see you, man. It's really nice to see that you're doing so well. And also, congratulations, because, I mean, you wrote a book. That's a really big deal.
Thank you so much. I feel like I've given birth to this huge child, and now I can kind of put that up.
That's nothing like giving birth to a huge child, just so you know.
I know that is actually true.
So you picked a pretty awesome topic, really deserves this kind of treatment. What exactly drew you to writing a book about the story behind Tetris?
You know, if you know anything about, you know, the history of video games or technology, you've probably heard at least a little bit about this weird history that Tetris has. It came from the Soviet Union. There were a lot of lawsuits and a lot of fights over who owned it. And I started to look into it, but I realized it wasn't really a video game history story. It was a startup story, and it was very similar to the startup stories that we talk about all the time out of Silicon Valley and everywhere else, except this was a startup story from Moscow in 1984, behind the Iron Curtain during the Cold War. And I said to myself, that's a really interesting story with modern day parallels.
And so you've got the story behind the game, obviously. And I mean, it's not just guy creates game, moves along, makes lots of money, and he wins. There's a lot of like almost espionage ties into the game. Can you talk a little bit about kind of those, how those link in?
Oh, yeah. During the Cold War in the Soviet Union, nothing is ever simple. And you certainly can't just like make a game and start selling it. This one guy, Alexei Pajitnov, he was a computer programmer working on some very high level stuff, actually. Things like artificial intelligence, voice recognition, things we're still working on today. And in his spare time, he decided to create kind of a computer version of a puzzle game he used to play as a kid called Pentominoes. And on his very primitive computer, he did it basically using the bracket keys to make the blocks. And all his friends liked it. The 20 people in Moscow at the time with computers all suddenly loved it. And to get a copy to somebody back then, you had to physically put it on a disc, walk it over to someone, you know, sneaker net it because there was no internet back then. And somehow it improbably becomes a viral hit and even sneaks out of, you know, behind the Iron Curtain, and some Western business people find it and they start wanting to sell it. And that leads to, you know, all this culture clash and business clash with the Soviet Union, who's suddenly going, hey, all these guys in the West are selling something we think is ours because, you know, it's communist and we own everything. We better figure out where this money is going.
What exactly is it about Tetris as a game that you think made it such a cultural phenomenon? I mean, why did it catch like wildfire the way it did?
Yeah, it could have been a cult hit like many, many other games, but instead we're still talking about it and still playing it 30-plus years later. There's something unique about the visuospatial elements of the game and the way it affects the brain, but it's also that it's a game that has no characters, has no language to it, has no story. So no matter what country you're in, no matter how comfortable you are with video games, I say Tetris is a game for moms and mathematicians and everyone else who would never call themselves a gamer. You can just watch it for 30 seconds, and now you know how to play. You don't need to read the instruction book. You don't need someone to translate a concept from another culture. And that was the big thing. It went from the Soviet Union to the UK to the US to Japan to every country around the world because it's one of the few games that's just so internationally translatable.
So I remember playing a lot of Tetris my freshman year of college. That was 1992. I don't know if that was like the tail end or the beginning, but I know that I remember spending like a beach vacation. Like
it was playing your Tetris summer.
Yeah, and I think I was playing on my MacBook, but I can't, you know, it was a long time ago. But I remember we used to also talk about how, like, we knew that it was created by a Russian, but there was this myth that was like they created it in order to get into our brains and, you know, control us. This was the early 90s. We still had the wall to think about it and everything. Is there any truth to that?
It's interesting. It's really the one successful cultural thing to come out of the Soviet Union that really penetrated the West. And you think of Tetris, you think of the red box with the backwards R, that plinky Russian, you know, folk music, almost the chiptune version of it. All that stuff was actually added by Western software publishers, MuraSoft in the UK and Spectrum Holobyte in the U.S. In order to make it seem like forbidden fruit, like something dangerous from behind the Iron Curtain. In Russia, they didn't need a red box because they know it's Russian. They're in Russia already.
Now I've got the theme song stuck in my head. So Alexei Pajitnov, I'm sorry. he's known to have basically missed out on profiting for much of the success of Tetris based on the fact that, you know, it was created behind the Iron Curtain, ongoing battles over rights that extended for years and years. Do you think that at this time, after all this time, you know, he's been able to kind of pivot into other directions and kind of find success tied to Tetris, but in other ways? Do you think that he would say that he feels vindicated at this point of his life?
Oh, definitely. I talked to Alexei a few times for this book. He's a really nice guy. The nice thing is he and a guy named Hank Rogers, who's sort of the other main character in the book, a kind of international software importer-exporter who went around the world trying to find different games that would work across, you know, different international borders. He actually created the Japanese role-playing game industry. He was a Westerner, and he created that industry by programming the first Japanese RPG called the Black Onyx. The two of them teamed up eventually, and after the Soviet Union collapsed, Hank and Alexei helped get Alexei's share of the rights to Tetris back, because once the Soviet Union is gone, it was kind of open season for all the things that government used to own. And today, all these years later, the two of them are partners in the Tetris company and administer the rights to the games. But Alexei moved to the U.S. in the 90s. He actually worked for the only other big organization that you would call the evil empire besides the Soviet Union. He worked for Microsoft for years. He created a game called Hexen that was installed, I think, on every Xbox 360 when you originally bought them.
Oh, interesting. What's the most surprising revelation that you encountered researching for the book? I'm sure it was like opening up a present, opening up a gift. You don't know what's always on the inside. What'd you find?
Oh, so much crazy stuff happening at the tail end of the Soviet Union when everything is sort of falling apart. A bunch of Nintendo executives had to go to Moscow at some point to do some negotiating. And a guy named Howard Lincoln is sitting there, famous Nintendo lawyer, later the president of the Seattle Mariners, sitting there in a conference room. And the Russians bring in a cosmonaut. And we go, hey, here's so-and-so. He's a cosmonaut. He wants to talk to you about the Russian space program. And they pitch Nintendo on sponsoring the Russian space program. Like, we'll put the Nintendo logo on the Soyuz capsule when we launch it up, you know, into space. And the Nintendo guy said, you know, we're going to have to think about this. We'll get back to you. And that never happened. But wow, wouldn't that have been cool?
Yeah, no kidding.
So you write that the game, playing the game, actually alters your brain. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I talked to a lot of different cognitive scientists while I was writing this book, and they all stumbled across Tetris as the perfect tool to use in brain science because of the very unique way that it affects the brain. It occupies a lot of the same highways in the brain that you use to write short-term memory to long-term memory, and it has a great effect on efficiency in the brain. So they would hook students up to PET scan machines and inject them with like a dyed solution so they could track brain activity, and they found that the more you play Tetris, you would think harder levels would be harder to play, require more brain energy. The opposite happened. You actually got more efficient. Your brain turned from a gas-guzzling SUV into a super efficient hybrid car just by playing tons and tons of Tetris. And another scientist found that Tetris could actually treat post-traumatic stress disorder by interrupting that writing of the memories, the traumatic memories, from short-term memory to long-term memory, in a way that you could still recall what happened, but you wouldn't get the same debilitating flashbacks. And that's research that's ongoing today.
Wow. See, it's good for you.
Yeah.
We should all play Tetris every day.
It's like implanted into my brain. I can still, like, sometimes I'll see squares and I move them around in my head.
Those are Tetris flashbacks?
Yeah.
That's that hypnagogic imagery, that waking dream where you perform a visuospatial task and then you see it with your eyes closed. And that's a term that somebody coined back in the 90s, and it's stuck to describe exactly that effect.
That is cool. So how do you feel about the new Tetris film? I think it's a three-part film, right? It has nothing to do with the backstory. It's such a although they had great opportunity here to create, to basically take the book that you've written and, you know, that into a motion picture. You've got a great, like, Bourne, kind of James Bourne espionage sort of thing, you know, potentially. What do you think about their plan?
It's very much like The Social Network, the movie that was originally The Accidental Billionaires, the book, a very kind of, you know, thrillerish sort of business startup story. So this is the same thing. But the movie they've been working on for a long time, even before I was working on this book, I guess it's a science fiction trilogy. You know, they made movies out of Transformers, out of Battleship, out of everything else. They can certainly, you know, make a movie out of Tetris. I have no idea what it would actually be about, but I think it would be interesting to see.
I would much prefer to see something based on what you've written here. Now, you narrated the audiobook yourself, which I'm very happy about. Very happy that it's in your voice. Have you ever done anything like that? What was that process like?
Yeah, I've never done anything like that before. I started out as a radio DJ, and obviously I do a lot of public speaking here at CNET. So when they asked me to come in and do the audiobook, I said, oh, that's great. No problem. I'll be right there. And they're like, we've booked you a week in the studio. And I was like, wow, that sounds intense. We did it in 3 days, like 9 a.m. to like 4 p.m., like straight through. It was one of the most physically strenuous things I've done in a long time, because you're sitting there perfectly still. You have to concentrate. You have to project for hours and hours and hours, and I'm holding on to the sides of the table so I don't make any extra noise. When I stood up after the first few hours, I thought I was going to pass out. I have tremendous respect for anybody who does audiobooks now. It's really hard.
Yeah, I had to imagine. Like, I've never been in within that process of listening to a lot of audiobooks. And I mean, you know, just talking on this show even for like an hour on Tuesdays where I have like a few shows back to back, that's really challenging. But with audiobooks, man, it's all about focus. It's all about enunciation, projection, reflection, all this stuff. So big time respect for the fact that you were able to do three solid days of that. I can't imagine doing that myself, personally.
I have my big supply of like green tea with a little honey. It keeps my throat, in tip-top shape.
Yeah, you got to do what you got to do. Dan Ackerman, it's always a pleasure talking with you, man. It's been too long. Where can people find your book online? What do you want people to know?
Yeah, it's so great to see you, Jason. It's available, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere you buy books online. You get the audiobook version from Audacity. Whatever your favorite bookseller is, I always love it when people go to their local bookstores.
Excellent. And you can check out more on this at Dan's site, danackerman.com. Dan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Thank you so much.
All
see you guys.
Best of luck.
Well, thank you to everyone who replied to my request for personal stories about the pros and cons of IT certifications. Bill from Campbell writes, I am a very firm believer in certifications and formal education. I only have an associate's degree in computer science, but I have a lot of technology certifications. I do not believe that I would have the job that I have today without the work that I put in to get the certifications that I have. It's because of my certifications that I've gotten to work at some really great companies. I currently work at Blue Coat Systems, acquired by Symantec, as a customer support engineer.
Excellent. You're not alone, because Timothy wrote in and said, I was a high school graduate with zero previous IT employment. Out of high school, I took 5 courses and got 5 certs, and those certs started my career in IT 10 years ago, and now with a few more certifications and experience, I've landed 3 amazing jobs during that time. Certs and the ability to apply what you learned in live scenarios, they're worth it.
And Sam writes, I work for a Microsoft Gold Partner custom software development shop, and our salary raises are dependent upon ongoing certification, mainly because Microsoft requires certain numbers of certified employees, along with other factors, to maintain our gold status, which has many benefits for us and our clients. I have my Office 365 MCSA, and I'm currently studying for the Linux on Azure MCSA.
Excellent. Thanks, Bill, Timothy, and Sam for writing in. That was awesome. Yeah. I love it. Up next, quite possibly everything Samsung makes is exploding. At least that's what the media seems to be saying. We'll talk about that a little bit. But first, let's take a minute to thank LinkedIn Learning, the sponsor of this episode. The shelf life of skills is less than 5 years. Many of today's fastest growing categories did not even exist 5 years ago. Introducing LinkedIn Learning. It's personalized, expert-led, on-demand e-learning from LinkedIn. You can keep your team engaged. It's all about educating your team, right? LinkedIn Learning is the perfect way to promote professional development within your team. LinkedIn Learning will identify the precise skills that you or your organization needs to achieve set goals. It'll also create personalized recommendations using LinkedIn network intelligence. Your teams can have access to more than 9,000 courses, and more than 25 courses are added every week. Their library includes courses taught by world-class industry experts, covering topics ranging from leadership skills to design principles and programming. You can learn anytime, anywhere. They have bite-sized segments that you can, you know, view on any device, online or offline. Those bite-sized videos provide immediate problem solving, and those can be downloaded to learn on the go wherever you happen to be. It's a perfect way to help team members close a skills gap without interrupting your latest project. Team solutions are available for as little as $2,000. Grow your network and your career. Visit learning.linkedin.com/twit to request a demo for your organization or get a free individual trial. That's learning.linkedin.com/twit. And we thank LinkedIn Learning for their support of Tech News Today. All right, TNT's fan of the day is Herb Ballou on Twitter, who says he's, quote, catching up on Tech News Today while I get the honeybees ready for winter, as Herb is very experienced in managing honeybees. That scares the crap out of me, to be honest. But he's got the garb on, so I think he's probably protected.
Yeah, I don't like bees either.
I like what bees do. I don't like being around bees.
Right. I like what bees do. I don't want to kill all the bees or anything. I like to imagine whenever people send this that I'm there with them, like whether they're riding their bike or, you know, taking a walk on the streets of Manhattan. But I don't know if I want to be there with those bees.
Well, we can through the comfort of that tiny device and not actually being stung. Mm-hmm. I see photos like this and submissions that we're getting lots of these right now. We always have them, but we're getting a ton of them right now. I just think it's really cool to kind of not only hear about how you guys are listening or watching or see your setup or whatever, but to see the kind of like the context it's placed into, like, you know, you listen to this show while you're beekeeping.
Right.
I never thought about that before, but that happens. That's really cool. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT or Beekeep. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. You can post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we'll find it.
Samsung is not having a good month. Hot on the heels of the Galaxy Note 7 recall. A lot of news outlets, including The Atlantic, are reporting that Samsung washing machines are now exploding.
No.
But if you read these stories, you'll see that exploding might be a bit of a hyperbole. The Atlantic says they're experiencing abnormal vibrations. The Washington Post says the machines could spin violently, levitate, and then, well, explode. They're flinging metal parts around the room. You have to say explode.
Yeah. I mean, when I first read this, I had the same response. I was like, come on, this isn't exploding. They're shaking violently, and then pieces are falling off and flying all over the place. Then I went on to Google, and it said, define explode. And it says, burst or shatter violently and noisily as a result of rapid combustion? No. Decomposition? No. Excessive internal pressure? Maybe. And other processes? Mm-hmm. Typically scattering fragments widely. So I guess it is exploding.
Yeah. So they have a website where you can go if you're concerned. They're only the top loading washers, not okay. the front loading. If you have a front loader, you're fine. Unless you also have a Samsung Galaxy Note that you haven't sent back, then you're not fine. And so you can check it out. I think this is sort of like, do you ever try to stick your giant comforter in the washer dryer?
Yeah, and it goes, and moves. Yeah,
so I think it's sort of, they advise not to do that. And yeah, so sorry.
So what else is Samsung making that's falling apart?
I don't know.
I'm sure some media outlet will let us know.
Yes, I'm sure.
It does seem like there's like the attention is all on Samsung and the blank thing that is blanking, you know, exploding or falling apart or whatever. The media is very hot to jump on this right now.
Hot.
Dang it. And apparently so are we.
Well, you know, I also saw a tweet about an iPhone 7 exploding like before it arrived.
So now it's just a thing for everybody to do.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, like batteries have been getting hot and, you know, for a long time. And burning things like this isn't, but now it's just like because it happened so much. And I do think this has a lot to do with like our desire for like a better, bigger battery, a phone to get here faster, you know, the better phone, like Samsung wanted to get it out before Apple.
Right.
I just think we're dealing with a lot of technology that can be dangerous. I mean, you know, so
sounds like we do it to ourselves.
We do it. It's our fault.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We should look inward if we don't want Samsung's batteries to explode anymore.
Right.
Look at ourselves.
Yeah. Wash your clothes in the bathtub like our grandparents did.
Yeah. On a washboard.
Yeah, exactly.
Wring them out and hang them up on a line.
Mm-hmm.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
It
just seems like it would take a long time. Megan, you are out tomorrow.
I am out tomorrow. I have an important Giants game to go see. And
there's an important meeting.
Yeah, important meeting in San Francisco that I can't hide because, you know, I have to put it on the social medias. So, you know.
Even if you were going to say that you were going somewhere like less, I don't know, going to a game and more like work related or something like that, you could end up on TV, kind of like
That's
a Ferris
true.
Bueller's Day Off.
Yeah.
And you don't want that to happen.
No.
So I'm happy that you're being forthcoming about your baseball game.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We're going to miss you. But I have enlisted the help of Jonathan Strickland from How Stuff Works to attempt to fill your spot. And we'll see how that goes. Actually, I know how it'll go. Jonathan's awesome. So he's going to be here tomorrow. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us. That's tnt@twit.tv. Leave us a short voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. And find us on Twitter. We're at Tech News Today TV.
You can find all the ways to subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to explain to me how baseball works, the Giants are a baseball team, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Tweet that to me and Megan Maroney because I don't know anything.
Well, it depends. Which Giants are you talking about? Are you talking about New York Giants? Are they in town? Because if so, that's football.
Oh, no.
Okay.
San Francisco Giants.
Okay. Yeah, you're good.
Okay,
you're
good.
You're probably going to get an email or a tweet now of some sort. I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to our technical director, Kara. Thanks to Burke for scrolling words on a screen. Thanks to Kevin for editing video, making us look good. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see you all tomorrow. Bye, everyone.